Reading this morning comes to us from Acts 27, verses 21 to 38, but I think I'm going to read a little more since we have a little more time. Oh, don't, Pastor, don't do that to us. But we have a little more time, so I want to get you in the mood of what's happening, and that Acts is Luke's sequel to his gospel. And Paul is the most important person in the book of Acts for Luke, because Luke accompanies Paul in his missionary journeys, at least in the latter part of his journeys. And Luke is a good storyteller, and I think he understands that the book of Acts is a long book and that his hearers might tire of what he's saying. So he throws one joke in it where Paul is talking at length one evening, and a young man who is sitting on a windowsill, two stories up, falls asleep in the middle of Paul's extended sermon. Are you familiar with that? And anyway, he falls two stories down, and everyone thinks he's dead. And Paul says, "No, let me heal him." And the young man is restored. And Paul goes back, having learned nothing, and continues to preach, which I think is Luke's way of not only castigating ministers, but also of injecting a little humor into the story. And now at the end, he injects kind of a Herman Melvillian tale, because Paul has been arrested in Jerusalem, and he's going to be beaten and strung up until Paul says, "You know, I am a Roman citizen, so I appeal my case to Rome itself. You cannot do anything to me." And so hands off it is, but they decide to ship him off to Rome. And they ship him off at a time where most sailing vessels are not sailing. In the Mediterranean, it's okay for you to sail along the coast from April to October. But after October, the Mediterranean is a very, very dangerous place. And especially when you had ships 2,000 years ago, which had just one mainsail, and that was it. If that sail went down, you were out of luck, and you would be spinning towards some whirlpool or maelstrom this way, or you could be grounded over here. And this is where Paul finds himself. They are in the middle of the Mediterranean near Crete, that island which had one of the most advanced and early civilizations we know of, the Mycenaean civilization. But for Paul, it's a nightmare. And what we see then is everyone is scared to death about what's happening, except Paul, who has great faith and translates it, transposes and transfers it to those in his midst. So let me start out and read a little more than I wanted to, but it's exciting stuff. It is Melvillian, like, well, it's better than Melville, because Melville was truly long-winded. But here we go. "When a gentle south wind began to blow, they thought they had obtained what they wanted. So they weighed anchor, and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called a nor'easter swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind. So we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboats secure. When the men had hoisted it aboard, they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold the ship together, fearing that they would run aground in the sandbars of Syrtis. They lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging. We finally gave up all hope of being saved. After the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, 'Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of the Lord, whose I am a follower and whom I serve, stood beside me and said, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar in Rome, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as God told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island." On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea. When about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that they would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved." So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it fall away. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. "For the last 14 days," he said, "you have been in constant suspense and fear and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive, and not one of you will lose a single hair from his head." After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all, somewhat of a communion service. Then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. This is the word of the Lord. An extended word of the Lord, I might add. I want to talk about being confidence givers and confidence receivers. And I kind of try to do both, but I realize we all may be in need of having a confidence giver in our lives so that we can receive confidence when our confidence has ebbed, like the sailors on board that ship. I'm sure they knew more maritime rules than certainly the Apostle Paul did, and no doubt that they had sailed the Mediterranean many times. And I know that it's implied because they were going from Jerusalem, and then another ship was going from Turkey to Rome itself. So that is a long trip, and you needed experienced seamen. But in the light of that terrible raging storm, they had lost the confidence and the maritime ability they once possessed, which perhaps was second nature to them. And suddenly they were frightened and scared, and they were going to abandon their passengers and try to make it to shore when it seemed as if the ship would ground and fall apart. And I guess I want to talk about what we need when the storms of our lives hit and when the confidence God has instilled in us through faith begins to wane or leaves us entirely. And I think the first thing I'd like to say is that we underestimate continually how stress impacts our lives, our decision-making, and our confidence in ourselves. That it is stress which undermines us. In 1939, Hans Selye wrote the classic book on stress, the earliest, and what he did was delineate two forms of stress. One was eustress. The Greek word euthus means good. And what Selye said is that there is some good stress in our lives, stress that motivates us to do whatever we need to do. And then he said there is also bad stress, he called it distress, and that prevents us from doing what we need to do with our lives. But when I look at that, it seems somewhat anachronistic that stress to me is always distress. It's stress, and stress is bad in our lives, and stress is always there because of our busyness and because of the world in which we live and deal, a world embalmed in secularism. And so, you know, we continually again underestimate how stress affects our lives, our decision-making, and our confidence. And we need people in our lives who are confidence builders. Sermons seem to write themselves for me this day, these days, and my 43-year-old, my oldest daughter, called me last night, and she said, "Dad, I lost the prescription, I lost the medication for my daughter, my 11-year-old daughter. I don't know what I did with it. I'm gonna have to go to the pharmacy and get a new prescription. And I also lost the prescription for one of our dogs, and she's having surgery soon, and I needed to put her on this antibiotic before the surgery, and I've lost them both, I put them right there. Dad, do you think this is the onset of early dementia for me? Do you think I have Alzheimer's disease?" You know, and I said, "Well, what else is going on in your life?" "Well," she said, "you know about the fact that I have Lyme disease." I said, "Yes, I do." "Well, what you don't know is that my mother has Lyme disease too, and she was hospitalized for a week in the hospital, and she said, 'Can I live with you for just a few days?'" And my daughter, Sarah, said, "Sure, live with me for a few days," which extended for a few weeks, which did not make my son-in-law, who's a great guy, happy. And so my daughter had to say to her mother, "You know, I don't think it's good for my marriage if you stay here any longer." My daughter said, "I could share this with you, by the way." "I would not do it otherwise, I really wouldn't." But she says, "No, you don't have to couch this in someone else's, some third party. No, you just tell them, you know." And she needed her father's advice, which is always wonderful to be able to offer that when I have some good advice, which is not often to give. But when I do, I give it. And I said, "You know, you are under so much stress. So much stress, and with other things that have happened in her life too, that it's amazing you know your name, let alone losing this, that, or the other thing." And then I said, "It may be genetic too, because whenever I'm under stress, moving, for instance, you know, I lose everything. I can't find my keys." And I said, to strengthen her and to normalize her stress, I said, "Look, I've lost the second transponder key to my truck. In less than 3 months, I've lost two keys to my truck, so I have to go back there and admit that I've lost another transponder key, which means another $250, which means I'm an idiot, you know." So, but I said to her, "You know, don't underestimate the stress you're under," and I say that to you too. Because we often kind of define stress as losing someone through death or a divorce. And you know, when you look at the stress charts, what's number 3 or 4 on that list is moving. Can you believe that? Well, believe it. And often I think, you know, if you really research your life, you can find areas in your life where you've kind of discounted, this is not stress-inducing, when in fact it is. And I think to be aware of that, of what stress is doing to you and where the stressors lay and lie, is so important to get a handle on that. And it may well be that what God calls us to do is to broaden our categories of what stress is. A move, a change of jobs, a promotion is also stress-inducing. Taking a group of teenagers down to Whitesburg, Kentucky is stress-inducing. I mean, I'm amazed that our two youth leaders are here this morning. That's a miracle in and of itself. You know, all of these things that we discount, don't. We are, as the psalmist said, fearfully and wonderfully made. The fearful part comes in the fact that there are many things that impinge on our lives which are stress-inducing And if we can figure out what they are, we, with the help of God, can help solve those situations. So the second thing I'd like to say is that the storms in our lives are temporary. And this is what Paul stresses to them. He says, look, because I believe in a loving God and a God who's on your side, this storm will pass. This storm will pass. It's only temporary. And my daughter needed to hear that. I said, look, this is temporary. You're going to get through this. I'm your dad. I'm a minister, so you have to believe me. You know, the storms in life will pass. But when we're in the middle of a storm, do we think it's going to pass? No way. We kind of look at that. We're stuck right in there, and we think, this is going to go on forever. This is not going to depart anytime soon. And it may be longer than we'd like it to be, but, you know, if we time it out in terms of the grace-filled moments in our lives, we realize that God is in the grace-filled moments and storms are temporary. They'll leave. And this is scriptural. You know, Isaiah writes, apart from the word of the Lord, all things pass. But the word of the Lord, that positive, hopeful word, remains forever. I have dear friends, a middle-aged couple who are newlyweds. And a few weeks ago, they were telling me that the wife had panic attacks. And her husband just kind of cradled her in his arms and said to her, this will pass. Look, you're going to get through this. This will pass. Let me just hug you. And let me read you something. And so he pulled out, as a little girl, her favorite character was Raggedy Ann, and a fellow named Johnny Gruelle wrote the first and only Raggedy Ann book in 1918. So he pulled out her copy of this Raggedy Ann book, and it was filled with pictures of Raggedy Ann, and he read that to her. And that calmed her. What a nice and loving touch that was, wasn't it? He understood what she loved as a child, what soothed and calmed her as a child. And so at midlife, here he is reading Raggedy Ann stories to her, and that calmed her. So, and that helped her to understand that the storms in our lives are temporary. And believe that. And just kind of look forward to the day when those storms will end and that you're going to have clear sailing. Because that is God's will. And the final thing I'd like to say is that a confidence giver and a confidence, a confidence giver always repeats his or her affirmation. That's biblical. A confidence giver always repeats his or her affirmations. God does it with Joshua. You know, don't be afraid, you're stronger than you think. Joshua 1, go in and take the promised land. You can do it, don't be afraid. God says it 3 or 4 times in Joshua 1. You can do it. And Paul says, if you note in our passage today, Paul says on 3 occasions, you know, you're going to get through this. You're going to be fine. Don't worry. It's a storm, but God's going to see you through this. And he sharpens it to a point where he says, not even the hairs on your head are going to be harmed. You know, even if you're a baldy, you're not going to lose any hair. You're going to be just fine. Don't worry about it. So Paul gives that positive affirmation not once, not twice, but 3 times. And in his second letter to the church at Corinth, which he founded, he says in chapter 7, I have great confidence in you that you can make the changes you need to make. I have great confidence in you that the troubles you see in the world that impinge upon you and the troubles you see in your church which impact you, you're going to solve them because of God's grace and God's love. I have great confidence in you. And then a few verses later, he says, I have perfect confidence in you. I rejoice because I have perfect confidence that you're going to get through this and you're going to do great things. So again, we need to affirm other people so that they can get their confidence back, and for us to get our confidence back, we need to be affirmed more than once. And who are those people you know in your life who delight in repetition, who gets that right? One of the people I admired most when I was in high school, well, any time, was my first wrestling coach, and I had him from 9th grade to 10th grade, and then he unceremoniously left for a better job as a teacher on Long Island. His name was Sully Mott, and he was a wonderful wrestling coach. Some of what he taught me I can't really use in church. He said, you know, you'd be a better wrestler. I want to get you to be a better wrestler. You need more of a killer instinct. So I can't really preach about that too much, although he was right. But there was another wrestler on our team who was almost unbeaten, but this one evening he lost a match. It was a tough match, and it was a weak wrestling team that we were wrestling, but this one guy had been a state champion. So our guy lost, and when he was coming off the mat having lost, Sully Mott yells out, "You're still a champ! Don't forget it, you're still a champ. You lost this one, but you haven't. You're still a champ, you're the best." And when he sat down in the seat and he was discouraged, and you know, Sully would say, "You're still a champ, don't forget it, you're still a champ." And you could see his posture kind of, he sat up in the seat straight. And so Sully followed all of us out after the match, and we put the chairs away, and his mother was waiting for this wrestler, and he kind of tapped on the door. It was a cold evening, and he said, "Please remind your son that he's still a champ, all right? Before he goes to bed at night, tell him he's still a champ." And she said to Sully Mott, "Okay, champ, I'll tell my son that he's still a champ." And we need to do that. We need to be confidence givers, and we can do it because we have confidence in the Lord. And we need to be confidence receivers. Know that God will put people and has put people in your life to give you what you need so you can be healed. Thanks be to God. Amen. Let us remember the words of our Lord when he said, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." Let us come before him with